gentlemen, Mr. President, Chief Justice, I come before you once more as a representative of the Harry S. Truman Library Corporation to preside this year, as I did last year, at a presentation of another distinguished work of art to the Truman Library. This year, the work of art is sculpture, and its subject is one of our most respected, capable, and sculptural American statesmen. From his name, we draw the name of this day. We're calling it the Dean Acheson Day at the Truman Library. Dean Acheson is particularly distinguished here because he was one of the vice chairmen of the Truman Library Corporation and one of the real builders of this building. He still regards it with fatherly concern and care and was looking around today to see if there were any cracks in the walls or any trouble with the pavement. As a witness and evidence of his great service to the library, I have a greeting to him from the president of the Library Corporation, Mr. Basil O'Connor, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, but who guided us in our fundraising and construction efforts several years ago. This message is addressed to Dean Acheson and reads as follows. On the occasion of this presentation, I remember with gratitude and respect our long association in the development and establishment of the Truman Library. The recorded history of the crucial period in which you shared with President Truman the burdens of state will forever bear witness to the integrity and devotion with which you served our country and its people. Please accept my congratulations and my best personal wishes. Signed, Basil O'Connor. The occasion for this celebration has been made possible by another member of the Truman Cabinet. Had it not been for his acumen and for his persistent efforts, not to mention his generosity, we would not have had in our possession this excellent piece of sculpture. He is, to put first things first, also a trustee of the Library Corporation and a vice president of it. His career of public service is long and honorable. It has its beginnings in the liberal political movement in Colorado in the 1920s and early 1930s and extends from there through the entire Roosevelt administration and the Truman administration in Washington, reaching a high point in his service as Secretary of the Interior. Fortunately, this gentleman has given his papers to the library, and here they will prove, no doubt, a gold mine for historians of all the American political movements and liberal movements of any importance during the last 30 years. He has been a trailblazer on many paths of human progress for our people. His ingenuity, his skill and persistence as a public servant are matched only by his warmth, his generosity, and his constancy as a friend. Mr. Oscar Chapman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. President, and Mrs. Truman, and Mr. Chief Justice, and Dean Acheson, and Mrs. Acheson, and now say Ms. Platt. It is a real wonderful occasion for me to be able to participate in this conference of scholars here today. And I might say that this is a special privilege that is mine on this particular afternoon. It is the culmination of a dream shared by the beloved speaker Sam Raven and me. When we learned of the splendid and wonderful sculpture of Dean Acheson, executed by Miss Platt, it seemed most fitting that this should be placed in the Truman Library. I wonder if I may at this point let you become better acquainted with Miss Platt. Would you mind standing, Miss Platt, please? We are all indebted to her for what I consider, purely as a layman, not as an expert, while wonderful execution of a portrait that we all not only love as the subject matter itself, but in the work. It's the finest I think I have ever known. And this has been a special appeal to me for several reasons. First, I was delighted to carry out a plan in which our beloved speaker was interested, Speaker Sam Rayburn. And second, this gave me an opportunity to express in a small way my own admiration of Dean Acheson, with whom I was associated in government for many years. Words are not adequate for me to express my full appreciation for this man, because I've known him for so many years and have admired him so long. I've seen him work under most difficult circumstances and under most pleasant circumstances, and always he comes up with a clear thinking mind. And he has blazed the way and shown us a trail in our foreign policy that I don't think that has been shown by anyone else in our generation. And I have always been especially fond of him, and I am pleased for this occasion that I can publicly say so. And third, because of my genuine interest in the Truman Library, I am delighted when anything can be added to complete the picture of the period in which we who served with President Truman were active in public life. The names that appear on the scroll that I'm about to read are only a sampling of the many friends who hold Dean Acheson in the highest esteem and admiration. The inscription on the scroll expresses the sentiment we all feel. And with your permission, I'd like to read this to Dean Acheson and to the audience. It's listed and headed to Dean Acheson. Surely the judgment of history will confirm the conviction of his friends and of a grateful people that here is one of those men whose power of mind and strength of will came forward to render decisive service at a hazardous juncture in the growth of freedom. Let history also record the affectionate respect of those of us who are privileged to have witnessed his grace and courage, and to have shared the pleasures of his friendship. That is signed by some 36 close associates and friends of his, leading with the first one as Harry S. Truman, Lyndon B. Johnson, and Sam Rayburn. Mr. President, it is difficult to be in such a position as this for me to say all the things that I'd like to say about Dean Acheson. With you sitting here, I could say the equal of the same fine things about you as President of the United States and as a human being. But for me to say all the things that I would like to say about you, Mr. President, I'm afraid not only the language would be inadequate, but my audience wouldn't believe me. But it's true. People who know President Truman, have worked with him so closely, have an admiration for him that is, I believe, is unparalleled. In all of my experience, it certainly is. And Mr. President, while today we are giving to you, as to the library, to your wonderful library out here, this wonderful portrait of Dean Acheson, I want to say to you with great pleasure, we turn these over to you, Mr. President, for you to have. You may give this.
It gives me a tremendous amount of pleasure to present this scroll to the greatest of the great secretaries of state, Dean. I'm happy to give it to you.
Thank you, sir.
Please, the chairman of this organization said it was time for me to make some remarks. Well, I'm in the same position that he said he was when I start to talk about Dean Acheson and Oscar Chapman and all the rest of the members of the cabinet who served with me. I run out of words. They did the work and I got the credit. And I'm never more grateful to anybody in the world than I am to this man right here. And it's a wonderful thing when I can participate in presenting to him and to the library and to receive from the Oscar Chapman Committee this portrait of, as I say, the greatest of the great secretaries of state. And there's not much more that I can say. I'm as happy as I can be that all of you are here today. I know very well that if this continues, this library will receive credit for having assembled more brains than any other institution in the country, including Yale.
President, Mr. Chief Justice, Ms. Platt, Oscar and David, and all my dear friends. This is a very moving experience for me. I am deeply touched at what the President said. Only a few days ago, he said something else like this in Washington when he presented me with a memento from Yale. I then said some things about him, which he has scolded me for, so I shall be very careful about that today. I'm grateful for what he said. I'm greatly touched that the Chief Justice should leave for a short time all the great burdens which he has and the mountain of work which he has in Washington to come here for this afternoon. I am deeply touched that a great artist should have combined with dear friends to do me this honor. I won't say anything about what Miss Platt has done of me, except to observe that what all of you have observed, that if Miss Platt would do self-portraits, the cause of art would be greater advanced. It would be great fun to talk about myself the rest of the afternoon, or have somebody else do it, perhaps. But I have been asked to make a speech to you, and so I am going to do that, partly to escape from my own embarrassment, partly to perform my part of this delightful afternoon. In thinking about what we might talk about, anything will be an anticlimax after what has been said about me. I thought I would pick out something particularly dry so it would be particularly anticlimactic. There has been a great deal of conversation in the post-war period about the handicaps and defects of a democracy and dealing with the great challenge which it faces in the world brought by dictatorships and totalitarian states. And so I thought that perhaps this afternoon we might look into this matter a little bit, because I'm persuaded that there are some handicaps, some of which are real and have to be faced, and some of which could quite easily be remedied if we chose to do that. And I thought perhaps we would look at these together and see which is which. I want to read to you something which was written by a man who knew a great deal about democracies and was written 130 years ago. This was by Alexis de Tocqueville, who, speaking of democracies and foreign politics, wrote this: "Foreign politics demands scarcely any of those qualities which are peculiar to a democracy. They require, on the contrary, the perfect use of almost all those in which it is deficient. Democracy is favorable to the increase of the internal resources of a state. It diffuses wealth and comfort, promotes public spirit, and fortifies the respect for law in all classes of society. All these are advantages which have only an indirect influence over the relations which one people bears to another. But a democracy can only with great difficulty regulate the details of an important undertaking, persevere in a fixed design, and work out its execution in spite of serious obstacles. It cannot combine its measures with secrecy or await their consequences with patience. These are qualities which more especially belong to an individual or an aristocracy, and they are precisely the qualities by which a nation, like an individual, attains a dominant position." Now, this was a pretty acute observation by a man writing 130 years ago. I think we can say that most of what de Tocqueville wrote still is true. I think I may add that some of it can perhaps be questioned. And I think we have to say further that a good deal more perhaps has to be said. Just to start off with, is it altogether true that only with great difficulty can a democracy regulate the details of an important undertaking, persevere in a fixed design, and work out its execution in spite of serious obstacles? I submit that that is open to doubt. And it, as an illustration that it is open to doubt, I would like to suggest the great measures which were taken by our chief, the former President of the United States, under the administration of Mr. Harry S. Truman, in the years following the war in his two administrations. Now, these were a great design. They were executed with skill. All those measures which he brought forward to create a new world, which I shall speak about a little more later, a new world out of the remains of a very broken one, to build up the strength which was necessary to defend that world, to try and bring hope and opportunity to people who did not have hope or opportunity. This was a great design, and it was worked out. Even the details were worked out well. So that I think perhaps we might suggest that de Tocqueville has overstated the case in this respect. As to perseverance, perhaps we had better wait a little before we boast. The United States has been barely 15 years at work upon this effort. And many people are tired of it already. We hear from Congress signs of anguish about some of the burdens we have undertaken. And it may be that he will turn out to be right, that it is very difficult for a democracy to persevere. But at any rate, we begin to see a ray of hope. The picture is not quite as black as he painted it. When we come to secrecy, I can't offer you very much hope. We regard secrecy as a sin. Secret diplomacy is a word, a phrase of opprobrium. Another phrase which we look on with great doubt is behind closed doors. I had always thought that the very conception of a door was that it might be closed. But apparently it is wrong to close it in the field of diplomacy. Of patience, we have very little indeed. And I think that this lack of patience comes from several of our most beloved cliches. We delight to say to one another that soldiers win our wars on the battlefield and statesmen lose the peace at the conference table. This is a pleasant thing to say because one likes soldiers and one dislikes diplomats. And therefore, it puts each one in his proper place. But it seems to me that it comes from a basic misunderstanding of the very nature of force. Force can do some things and it can't do other things. This is what is not understood in this cliche. What can force do? Force can overcome other force. This is its only achievement. If one is opposed and one has greater force than the one who is opposing one, that force can be overcome. There is then a beaten and defeated enemy. What happens at that point? And here is where force becomes quite a useless weapon in the hands of a democracy. A democracy cannot use it as a dictatorship, an autocracy can, to continue to crush a defeated enemy and to force that enemy to accept an alien rule and alien dictatorship. It just can't do it. It isn't in the nature of a democracy to accept that sort of a burden. And the British for years thought they could do it in Ireland. And again, they thought they could do it in India. And the French thought they could do it in Algeria. The trouble was not that they didn't have enough force, but that they couldn't, in compatibility with their own consciousness and their own inner life and ethical standards of a democracy, they could not use their force for that purpose. And therefore, the moment a war is over in which a democracy has been evicted, the moment the enemy is defeated and the arms are struck from its hands, a wholly new situation occurs, a situation where force is of very little importance indeed, and where we return almost to the very processes of a democracy itself, which is to win the consent of the defeated enemy in a new endeavor conceived for the mutual benefit of both victor and vanquished. This indeed was the great achievement of the Truman administrations. Yet that achievement was not to regard Germany and Japan as enemies, but to regard them immediately as the subjects of reconstruction, to change their attitude, to restore their broken economies and their disrupted society so that they might both again become members of a world order. And so it seems to me that here again there is the possibility of hope. There is a possibility of patience. Once a democracy can really understand what it is trying to do. Impatient people say we must, a wonderful phrase they have coined, we must wage peace just as soldiers wage war until we smash through to victory. This is just ridiculous talk. You cannot wage peace in this forceful and vigorous way. You cannot smash people into being good or being good citizens of the world. All these ideas are alien ideas. And therefore, once a democracy begins to understand what it is that it is trying to achieve, it may be patient in waiting for those consequences, because they are not consequences which occur overnight. And perhaps, too, a democracy can help itself by revising its institutions so that there is an opportunity for patience. I've often talked with President Truman about the problem which is presented in our country by the frequency of elections to the House of Representatives and to 1/3 of the Senate. If there is to be an appraisal of the activities of a Congress every 2 years, there is not much ground for patience. Congress can hardly enact substantial measures in 2 years. And if one wants consequences, there are not going to be any consequences. This crop is a hard crop to plant, and you cannot expect it to sprout when it has just been put in the ground. Therefore, it would be wise, if a democracy is to learn some patience, to have some institutions which made patience possible. Now, in going further and looking at these difficulties, I have endeavored to put them into two categories, which I mentioned before. Some that one can hope to remedy, others those which one must live with. The deeper ones, the ones that go to the very nature of democracy in any land, or to the very nature of our institutions in this land, when they are confronted with a conflict which was never anticipated. First of all, let me take two illustrations of handicaps which could be cured without too much difficulty from the role of the Congress in relation to foreign affairs. These illustrations are not inherent in the system. They aren't the result of law. They are merely the result of inertia. One of them is the wholly fortuitous result of the seniority principle as applied to the committees of the House and of the Senate. Here, the wayward personality is extolled into its most unhappy apotheosis. Mere chance, not party action, not the healthy back and forth fight of parties, but mere chance brings somebody, we can think of this if we try hard enough, in the field of appropriations for foreign aid. You bring into the picture somebody who has a particular scunner against this particular form of activity. And the whole work of the democracy is made infinitely harder than it has to be because somebody is where he shouldn't be. He might be excellent in some other place, but in this place he is not. And yet the seniority rule brings this about. It makes impossible a thing which presidents of both parties have wanted to bring about, and that is the long-term financing of foreign aid instead of being able to plan only for 12 months at a time. Another matter of this same sort, coming out of the same field, the role of the Congress, is the practice which has grown up. No requirement in the Constitution, no requirement in law, of having annual appropriations and annual authorizations for most of the important programs of government. Now, this is a sheer obstacle race. This is just making it hard for yourself for fun. Actually, Congress wants to retain more control than it's entitled to retain over the executive by this interminable squirrel in a cage activity. 4 times a year, important members of the government, any number of their assistants, any number of members of Congress have to listen to the same speeches 4 times. You could wake up in the middle of the night and make these speeches after a while, and you do this every year, day after day after day. The time of the Congress, the time of the executive, the time of the press, the time of all sorts of important employees of the government is taken up by merely reciting over and over and over again the same words. I've often thought with envy of a Buddhist prayer wheel. If we could just put something up and turn it by hand, satisfy these people, it would seem to me to be important.